Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome to New Books and Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm a host on the channel. And today I'm thrilled to be talking again with Daniel Feierstein. Daniel is a return guest, and I encourage listeners to go back and listen to our 2015 discussion about his book, Genocide as Social Practice. This time he's here to discuss the first volume of an in-progress trilogy titled Memories and Representations of Terror, Working Through Genocide. Daniel, welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show. And thanks for joining us again on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Okay, thank you, Kelly, for inviting me again. That's really nice.
So it's been a while. Can you maybe reintroduce yourself to the listeners and help our listeners or maybe say why the violence in Argentina has formed such a center point for your academic research?
Yeah, so my field of expertise is mainly sociology. I'm a sociologist, a doctor, so PhD in social sciences. And my main work during the last 30 years, I would say, is trying to analyze genocidal social practices, genocide as a technology of power. And after finishing my previous book, Genocide as a Social Practice, the need that appeared was to work on the question of memory as the very important element of genocide as a technology of power, the ways in which the society represents the terror. So I started working with Nazis in the 1990s. But then this work was used in my own country, and that's why I made the Argentine experience a focal point, not only intertwine my work with the situation in the country, but also because we will talk about that, but the Argentine case was really interesting in terms of the ways of representations of the past. And that's my feeling that could be really useful to understand wide idea of how these different representations could work. So that's a brief presentation why we are here.
Excellent, thank you. So when I think about the word trilogy, I usually think about fiction novels. Help me understand, or maybe I should say, introduce to us the idea behind this set of works and what you hope it will do.
Yeah, the idea of a trilogy, the trilogy is working through genocide. And the idea of the trilogy is that to understand this work through, just taking the expression from the psychoanalysis, this Freudian idea of working through, that for working through, we need three different levels. And that's the idea of the trilogy, that we have a first level regarding the ways of representations, memories and representations. That's the first volume we are presenting here, we are talking about. The second volume is the idea of the judgments. So when you have a representation of what happened to you, then you have the possibility to judge and the human ability to judge. And then the third level of the working through process is the responsibility. Mm-hmm. So when you have a representation, you have a judgment, and then you have to answer for your own actions or for the consequences of your actions in others. And that's the idea of responsibility. So the trilogy is memories and representations, judgments, responsibilities. I have written two volumes. This is the first one, which is being published in, it was published in English last year. Second volume was published in Spanish in 2015. Mm. And it was not translated yet. And the third volume, Responsibilities, is the one in which I'm working now. So it is still a work in progress. Mm-hmm. I'm finishing the third volume.
So this is a remarkably interdisciplinary work. Some of our audience are graduate students or early career professionals. What can you say to them about how you go about the process of trying to become as interdisciplinary in terms of expertise as this book would require?
Yes, and it is particularly, I love, I would say, not only interdisciplinarity, but transdisciplinary, mm-hmm. the possibility to work through different disciplines, because when I was a student, one of my best professor was a very important epistemologist, Rolando Garcia, mm. who worked together with Jean Piaget. He taught me that reality has no disciplines. So this taxonomy of discipline is a need of abstraction to simplify reality, which is okay, it is needed. But in reality, we have no disciplines. In reality, everything is together. So to really comprehend something, you really need the different disciplines. Mm. But in this process in particular, it was quite important, because what I have identified in previous years is that particularly in the social sciences, when most of the scholars talk about memory, they know almost nothing about the way, the organic way in which memory works. Mm. So my feeling was it is impossible trying to think how social memory works if you know nothing about how the neuroscience of memory works. So that's why the first chapter is about it. But it took me 3-4 years of study on neurosciences. So being a PhD in social sciences, I took different seminars, of postgraduate seminars on neurosciences, mm-hmm. trying to understand the way in which memory works. And again, it was the same regarding the psychic apparatus, in which, okay, you can't talk about memory in a social dimension if you can't understand how the psychic apparatus works. Mm-hmm. But it's not the same. So again, I had to start. So it was a book. This book took me around 10 years of study, because I knew almost everything about the social dimension, but I needed, and even the historical dimension, but I needed concepts and being embedded in these concepts of neurosciences and psychoanalysis, being able to put everything together, trying to understand that reality mm. of the representations of terror. So beyond, I love this idea of transdisciplinarity. In this case, it was really needed in order to understand the whole process.
Yeah. You've just terrified people who are on the tenure clock, but that's okay. I will consider my job well done. But it does remind us of the practical realities of being an academic and the structures that exist in academia that encourage us to publish quickly and thus to publish in our discipline. So the heart of this book is a really close examination of narratives of violence. And I want to get there, but I would like to start at the end of the book as a way of maybe transitioning between our last interview and this one. where you write a short little chapter about your notion of the symbolic enactment of genocidal social practices. Can you say, to those people who are not familiar with your work, what do you mean when you say symbolic enactment of genocidal social practices, and why is that important?
Yeah, that's fundamental because that's the reason of the book. So you went directly to the main part. Yes, because when I did a lot of work trying to understand genocidal social practices, and particularly these brilliant intuitions of Raphael Lemkin, the creator of the word genocide. One of the most important and insightful ideas in Lemkin is that genocide is not just the extermination, but that the terror of the annihilation process has another fundamental and strategical objective, which is the transformation of identity. But the transformation of identity means that the real objective is not the people who are being killed, but the people who survived. That the terror produced by the killings has the objective to modify the identity of the rest of the society. So if you take this idea, so genocide doesn't end or doesn't finish with the extermination, but it has one more step, which is the ways in which the society can't represent what happened in the moment of terror or annihilation. And that's what I have called symbolical enactment, because Lemkin has this brilliant idea, but he never developed how this idea works. So how is the way in which identity are transformed? And the way of identity transformation is representations. So if there is a step of representations that happen after the annihilation, so you need a name for that step, which is the symbolical enactment, which is the ways in which this representation really fulfilled or achieved the objectives of the genocidas. But what I write in the book is that the difficult part of this last stage is that it cannot be guided by the genocidal. Because no one can be in our minds in order to guide how are we able to represent the past or the situation of terror. So what happens? That I used to say that symbolic enactment is a kind of bet. So is the genocidal can imagine that human beings used to react in these ways when they are submitted to terror. So there is a strong possibility that the representation of that terror will follow this pattern, but there is no way to influence that, but just producing the terror, and then it is a bet that it will work. And the interesting point regarding different societies is that not necessarily works. It depends on what do we do with the situation we have lived. So that's the interesting point, that genocide continues in this symbolical enactment, and there is a way to fight against these consequences if we try to work with the representations of the past.
Well, let's move from there to the first three chapters, where you kind of lay the groundwork for memory and the way it might equip us to address past and current crises. And you start with neuroscience. And so I wonder if you could say a little bit about what scientific discoveries by neuroscientists show us about memory. I'll just stop there and let you go.
Yeah, no, that's really fascinating, because neuroscience has a lot of discoveries and advances over the last 30, 40 years. It was a huge jump, I would say, because it was impossible to know until the 70s, something like that. And then it was just a jump and a lot of discoveries. And many of them, the most important, because I have analyzed in the book just some of them, the most important for us, for a social science perspective, is that some of the assumptions of the philosophy and the social sciences about the memory were wrong, were totally wrong. This idea that we live something, we record what we have lived, and then the process of rememoration, when we can work there and take the remembering, and that's not the way in which it happened. And that's particularly interesting that memory is a creative system. So there's no way in which we record, or to say better, there is a recording, but this recording is absolutely fragmentary. So the scene we have lived is nowhere. There is no way to record the scene. The scene is a construction. It's a construction in which we gave sense to the different fragments we have recorded. And give sense means introduce a narrative in which we explain what happened. But that narrative is an act of imagination, is an act in which our mind is always trying to make sense of reality, but it doesn't mean that reality has sense. We need to make sense of reality. So that's discoveries are fundamental to understand the representations of the past, and particularly, I would say, for the more positivist of the historians. Well, that is really problematic, because this idea that you can really take the real memory, even for the law, with the idea of the witness, and the witness has to go to his memory because his or her memory is absolutely exact, but nothing like that exists. That to understand the way in our brain works is fundamental to continue working in different levels. So that's why neuroscience is the first chapter. I know it is somehow harsh to go there because it is the first chapter, so technical. And sometimes I would say that the concepts from the social sciences, even some concepts from psychoanalysis, are more known in the general audience. But talking about the way in which the brain works is a bit more difficult. But I think it was really necessary going there, trying to understand this first organic material level, to work in other levels of complexity, but taking in account that it shouldn't contradict this level. So if my social science hypothesis, imagine a brain which is not the way in which the brain works, so it's wrong. It's definitely wrong. So we need first to understand how it works, and then to work from to the following level.
Yeah, I loved the metaphor, and I don't remember whose it was, about the idea that memory is like a glacier thawing and refreezing, which I'd never heard before and made me rethink a lot of things. You bring, and one of the it, moving from neuroscience, you talk about the idea of desensitization and the way it prevents survivors from coming to terms with a traumatic past. So, what do you mean by this desensitization? How does it happen, and what effects can it have?
Yeah, I would say this, regarding the metaphor, I agree, is the Gerald Edelman metaphor. I think it's great, this idea of freezing and defreezing, and again, freezing again with the rest of the last defreezing, so that the memory always goes to the last moment in which we remember, not to the first one, which is lost. So we construct with the last moment. Regarding desensitization, I guess it is very important to understand that it is an adaptive answer. Most of the ways in which we represent the past are adaptive answers. ways in which we try to continue living and ways in which we try to continue giving sense to our life. So the idea of desensitization is that I have taken this idea from the works of Eric Kandel, which is a very known, is a Nobel Prize and very known neuroscientist. And this idea is that when you are in a situation in which you are submitted to pain, but there is no way to respond to that pain because you cannot fight and you cannot fly, so there is no way you cannot escape. So the sensitization is useless. Mm-hmm. So the pain is useless because the pain is a signal. Mm-hmm. But when it's a signal for doing something, but when you are in a situation in which you cannot do anything, so pain is useless. So there is an adaptive response in which you are, I would say, disconnecting your own system of pain, mm-hmm. because it is no more useful. So this first level, which is directly the question of pain, when we go to this following level, which is the psychic apparatus, mm-hmm. works in the same way, which the internal suffering, just not the pain, but the internal suffering has also the objective of give you some possibilities to react. But if that possibilities of reactions are forbidden, are problematic, there is no way. Sometimes you need to desensitize also in the psychic level in order to adapt. But the problem is this desensitization has very important consequences, and it cannot be deleted or eliminated once the situation of danger finished. So it's not so automatic. So the process is that when you are going through a desensitization process, it is quite difficult to go back, even if the situation finished decades ago. So that's the way to work through. This Freudian idea of working through is trying to dismantle or to change the structures we have created in moments of suffering, in moments of pain, in moments in which these structures were adaptive, but maybe they are dysfunctional or really problematic, or even realizing the objectives of the genocidas years later. So that's the idea of this complex process of desensitization, which is fundamental in the whole book, but particularly in the chapter 1 and 2, but I would say in the whole book.
Yeah, what are ideologies of non-meaning?
Yeah. The ideologies of non-meaning is a way to understand a very complex and developed way of desensitization. It is a concept I have created, this idea of ideologies of non-meaning, but the idea of the concept is trying to go in these transdisciplinary works, trying to go to more complex levels, to which, well, in the level of the organic functioning is clearly an organic disconnection regarding the pain. But in the level of the social exchanges, the idea of construction of meaning in a way in which nothing has meaning is a very effective way of disconnection. And that's why, in my opinion, these postmodern ideas are particularly hegemonic in moments of defeat, in moments of in which it appears that we have no real options, that we have to accept the horrible realities in which we are living. So these ideologies of no meaning, these ideologies which are particularly cynicist, or I would say, yes, this idea of it is difficult to find sometimes the English word, but nihilist, I guess it exists in English, this nihilism. I think that's a way of adaptive answer to the difficulties for my identity if I have to accept that I'm not doing anything to change this horrible world. That the idea of the world has no meaning helps me in the idea that even if I can't do anything or I can't, there is no importance because the world has no meaning. So that's the idea of this ideology of no meaning, that if never there was an identity that was destroyed, so there is nothing to mourn because there is no identity. Identities are just creations with no meaning. So if the identity exists, if it doesn't exist anymore, if it was destroyed or not, finally, it's not so important because never there were identities. So that's the idea of these ideologies of no meaning.
So I would love to have 2 hours to talk about this, but we don't. So I thought maybe here I would just say, as we move toward that question, the of how concepts like war and genocide and other crimes against humanity are employed in Argentina, I would just give you a chance to say, so what else should we know about that you've kind of drawn from your transdisciplinary studies? What else should we know that helps set that discussion up about the concepts in Argentina?
Yeah, so the whole world of the book and the research gave me another entry to the main discussion in genocide studies regarding qualifications of the facts. Because I think that the whole discussion is the orientation of the whole discussion is wrong. Because the main orientation is we have these concepts are realities, war, genocide, crimes against humanity, states, and so they are labels, and we have to find which one is the correct. So we have different realities, and we have to adapt history to these realities. And the proposal of the chapter 4 in the book is just move out from that discussion and take a more important discussion, which is to take from the other corner, which is not taking those labels as realities, but trying to understand the consequences of the different narratives. So the idea that war, genocide, crimes against humanity, state terrorism are different ways to give meaning to the past. And those different ways, the four of them could be correct, but they produce different consequences in the working through. So the idea is not to find that this is the one which is correct and this is the one which is wrong, so that these authors are correct and these authors cannot understand the reality, because it is interesting. Because when you see the reality that way, you think that all the people who disagree with you are a kind of stupid people that cannot understand how the reality is. And when you have hundreds of scholars that qualify facts in different ways, and all of their works are really great works, so maybe we have to understand that we should be more humble. And that maybe the problem is not that all of them are stupids, but that maybe the situation is much more complicated. That the four positions could be right if you follow their assumptions. So the problem is not if it is right or it is wrong. All of us recognize that the facts happened. No position is saying that the annihilation never existed, we did something different, or that the kidnappings never happened. But what are we discussing, and how are we giving meaning to these facts? In which way we are connecting the facts, and which is the way of meaning we are constructing from these facts? So one way would be this ideology of no meaning, so but it is out of the academia, but this idea now the facts has no meaning at all. But we have four different ways, which I analyze in chapter four different ways of giving meaning. And the most important question is not which one of them is correct, but the most important question is what are the consequences of the four different ways of giving meaning? And the concepts is just the way in which the concept work in that particular society. Because what I have analyzed in the case of genocide is that the way in which the concept of genocide functioned in Argentina regarding the way in which gave meaning to the facts was totally different than the way in which the genocide concept worked in Guatemala. So in Argentina, created some consequences, in my opinion, particularly interesting in the working through process. And in Guatemala, the same concept utilized in a different pattern of meaning produced very negative and problematic consequences to understand and to give sense, to give meaning to the past. Because in the case of Guatemala, it fractioned, it was a split, a separation between the political victims and the, I would say, ethnical victims or the indigenous movement. And it was really problematic because in the Guatemalan case, all of them were together, and the process of destruction was trying to destroy both elements at once. So trying to fragment this idea that the indigenous people suffered genocide, but the same people living in the same place and being killed in the same way, they are not victims of genocide. That is particularly problematic for the working through process. In the case of Argentina, it was exactly the opposite, because the way in which genocide was understood was this idea of partial destruction of the Argentine national group. So the idea is that all of the victims were part of the national group. So all of them were part of the same process. And I would say Nazism is the same discussion. Jews and gypsies are in one direction, and communists or handicapped or other people are in other. Some of them are victims of genocide, but the others are not. That is quite problematic, because then you have the communist Jew, and one half of him was part of the genocide, but if the reason was his communism and not his Jewishness, how do we work? Well, that is really problematic in the problem of understanding the past. That is really problematic in the problem of working through. But it is not because some perspective is wrong. It is because the consequences this perspective produce in the identities of the society after the genocide.
For the listeners, this is a nuanced, very carefully thought through argument, and there's no way to kind of tease everything apart today, and I'm not even going to try. I would suggest you go read the book. But for now, to give the audience kind of a sense for where that argument goes, you talked a little bit about genocide and its uses, and consequences. What about war? For those people who apply war as the concept for the facts, the events that happened, what are the consequences for that way of narrating events?
Well, I used to say that all of these narratives has advantages and disadvantages. And finally, the analysis is the balance between these advantages or disadvantages. So we can talk about war, which I have analyzed very well in chapter four. And I would say War has a very, very important advantage to understand these conflicts, which is that precisely that the conflict is present.
Mm.
In others' perspectives, even in most of the in most of the narratives that use genocide, but particularly in crimes against humanity, the conflict is absent. And that is really problematic. It's this binary idea that you have good people, you have bad people. So the bad people used to kill the good people, this idea of innocence and guilty people. That's really simple and problematic and never express the reality. No one kill no one because he's a good, he's a bad guy. So uh-huh. that's not the real reason. So war has this very important advantage. You have, you can see the conflict. In war, you have conflicts. You have people struggling. You have reasons for the battles, for the struggles. So that's a very important advantage. But the main disadvantage of war is that you always analyze the situation from a militaristic viewpoint. And the element of identity present in the conflict is hidden. This idea that you are not, it is difficult in war trying to work with this these identity problems, but on the other side, the idea of war is a somehow symmetrical confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when the state decides to transform the identity of the society, and even if there are some groups that could resist this changes and transformation, there is no real symmetry, and that what's happened. That's why the concept of genocide appear, or even first war crimes and then crimes against humanity, but then genocide with the idea that it's another project than war. And I used to say that the most important difference between war and genocide is that in war, what every contendant, every part want to destroy is a social force. You want to destroy the social force of the enemy. But in genocide, you have something more deeper, which is the project of transformation of social relation, not only of social force. I know it is very nuanced. I know it needs to more talking about that or reading the book. But I think that that's a very problematic consequence of using war, just confusing this element of social force and social relation and the deepness of the process of destruction. But it has the advantage regarding the other concept of putting the conflict on the table. So that's the interesting point. I tried to analyze the in the more objective way I could, which is not always, it is impossible to be objective.
Yeah.
And I point out this in the introduction that I have my own position, and I'm not trying to hide my position, but to give the reader the possibility to discuss with me, to know where I'm, which is my position. But I try to be as most objective as possible, trying to analyze the advantages and disadvantages mm-hmm. of the different narratives and construction of meaning.
You touched a little bit on crimes against humanity. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit?
I would say the crimes against humanity is the more liberal perspective, which is interesting because in one way it is interesting because the respect for the rights of each human being, that's the main idea of crimes against humanity. Crimes against humanity is the idea that the state has destroyed the different rights of different people, and beyond who the people are, it is not important because everyone has its own right to be respected. So that's so liberal in that way that the main perspective is we have human beings, we have persons, we have citizens in the legal way, and we have the state and the obligation to respect those rights. But the main problem is that the level of disappearance of the conflict is particularly problematic, in which when you also have human beings, citizens, persons, and the state, the problem is that the social groups and the ways in which the conflicts used to happen between or among social groups is absolutely hidden. It is not in the paradigm of the rights of the individuals. So I think it is a very interesting narrative in order to protecting the rights, but it is a really problematic narrative in order to work through, because the problem of working through is trying to recover the identities that were destroyed, but the identities that were destroyed are always social. It is not, there is no identity in one individual. The identity is collective, is dynamic. It means social groups interacting. And it is that's why the legal field used to choose crimes against humanity is the more used and the most common way, and it was the much more effective because the law continues analyzing the social conflicts with the ideas of the 17th or 18th century. It is 200 years ago. So no one in social science defends the ways in which the law thinks about social action. So as the law is particularly individualistic in this understanding of the social action, so that's why crimes against humanity, which is a very individualistic understanding, it is particularly useful for the law, but particularly problematic at the same time because the social dimension is hidden.
Well, as we've been talking, I've been thinking about what it means to interview someone about the first book of a trilogy. And so I think at this point, I will say it's halftime, or maybe a break between quarters, I guess between thirds. I can't think of a sporting event that's divided into thirds, but and say to listeners, okay, so you have your assignment, go read the book, explore. Now that you've got kind of a tasting menu of the book, go immerse yourself in the book. And hopefully, when the next volume is translated into English, we'll be able to talk to Daniel again, and pursue this. But until then, I'll end the same way I always do, Daniel. I wonder if you could suggest a book or a movie or something that listeners can use to expand their knowledge or their thinking about this subject, something that was meaningful to you.
Yes, I would say for this first volume, then we can choose for the other two.
Yeah.
For this first volume, a film that was really fundamental to my work and it was really insightful was a film titled Waltz with Bashir. I don't know if it's a very interesting film because it is a kind of comic. It has only real photographs at the end of the film, but then you have a kind of comic. And it is about the bombardments of Sabra and Shatila in Lebanon in 1982 by the Israeli forces and the annihilation of the population of the camps by the Falangist right-wing groups in Lebanon. But the interesting point is that the film is not about the facts. but about the way in which some of the Israeli soldiers can represent the facts and what they can remember and what they cannot remember, and how the psychic apparatus works, and how this idea of giving meaning. And so all of the elements I was trying to understand were just in that film, but it is not an academic film, and that was isn't interesting, but it is particularly insightful. It is a great film, Battles with Bashir. So that's my recommendation.
Well, as we were chatting about before we started taping, it is my spring break week next week, so I now know what I will be doing. So thank you so much. And thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking with Daniel Feierstein about his book, the first volume of his trilogy, Working Through Genocide, Memories and Representations of Terror. Daniel, I hope that I wish you luck in finishing the trilogy. I hope that it gets translated again, and I hope that if so, that we get a chance to talk to it. But in the meantime, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kelly. And it seems Routledge will be publishing the second volume during the next year or two. So probably we will meet again, I hope, if you invite
Excellent.
me. Thank you very much.
That is good news. Thank you.